TED Audio Collective.
You're growing a business, and you can't afford to slow down. If anything, you could probably use a few more hours in the day. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate, no coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Hi, I'm Ben. I suffer from a condition called writer's block. It strikes when I'm at work. That's why I choose Canva Magic Write. It works fast, generating texts in seconds, thanks to AI.
Common side effects include increased productivity, compliments from coworkers, feelings of satisfaction.
Now I can say bye-bye to writer's block.
Ask your boss if Canva Magic Write is right for you at canva.com, designed for work. Canva.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Persistence is a real quality of both an entrepreneur and a reporter. Persistence, you know, persistence, persistence, persistence. And an ability not to be pushed back if you think you are correct.
Hey, everyone. It's Adam Grant. Welcome back to Rethinking, my podcast on the science of what makes us tick with the TED Audio Collective. I'm an organizational psychologist, and I'm taking you inside the minds of fascinating people to explore new thoughts and new ways of thinking. My guest today is Kara Swisher. She's widely considered the most influential and most feared journalist in tech. I know from experience, having been grilled on her podcasts On and Pivot.
I try to be straightforward with people, when I'm coming at them. I think that helps, which is why people come back.
This time, I got to ask the questions. She came to the Authors at Wharton series for a live discussion of her new book, Burn Book, A Tech Love Story.
Kara Swisher, welcome
Hi.
To Wharton. All right, first thing I want to say is you remind me of both of my grandfathers.
Oh, wow, okay. We're going to go there, okay.
Which is not, I just realized how weird that sounds.
Yes, it does.
Both of them, Jay and Paul, were endearingly grumpy.
Ah, interesting. Okay, thank you, I guess.
Well, do you think that's a fair description of you?
No, I do not, but...
But you're demonstrating it right now.
No, but it's not grumpy. Why is the word grumpy you're using?
Maybe endearingly gruff.
Gruff, why is that the word you're using?
I think your default is critical and disagreeable.
No, why is it disagreeable? I don't know.
Case in point, I rest my case, Your Honor.
It's not disagreeable, it's...
Challenging? Feisty, how about feisty?
That's fine, if you need to do that. But I would say I am... you could possibly compare me to Larry David, but he started it, right? He started it. I'm skeptical, I would say, and also curious. I definitely am curiously skeptical. That's how I would...
What I appreciate about it and what reminded me of my childhood is I never have to question where I stand with you
right.
or wonder
so that's
whether
called,
you're being
It used
candid.
To be called honest, but go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. But sometimes you're willing to buck social norms and politeness expectations in order to be honest.
Which is... dishonest. That's, you know, like...
Agreed.
You look great, that kind of thing, you know. By the way, you look great.
Now I'm never going to believe
do.
A thing
I'm
you
I'm admiring
say.
This soft thing you're wearing.
I'm just going to leave that right there.
But what's interesting is if you go to people, sometimes I get, oh, you're mean. I'm like, where? Where was I mean precisely? And they can't find it, right? Because the default with women is if they're straightforward, they're mean or they're a bitch, really. It works for me, and that's what I'm like. And I think most people, if you happen to be shy, be that way. If you happen to be this, be that way. But it's better if you're true to what you're like instead of pretending, because I think it makes you sick in a weird way. I remember being closeted for a brief time. In the before times, you really had to be. And I really hated that. I really disliked that. And it prevented me from doing a lot of things. And I remember promising once I came out that I wouldn't do that again in my life. So
it's hard to imagine you putting on what Pat Hewlin and her colleagues would call a facade of conformity.
I think it was dead obvious to most people, but it wasn't said. I wanted to join the military, and I couldn't. The first part was because you actually got kicked out and jailed and all that stuff. And then the second part was don't ask, don't tell, which was under Bill Clinton. People don't realize that he did that. I was like, I like to ask and I like to tell. This is going to be an issue for me. And I couldn't do something that I really wanted to do. I very much wanted to join the military.
Well, I'm also glad you didn't.
I know.
I feel like some of your talents would not have
been. No, I would be an excellent admiral right now, and we would be safer for it, let me just say. So, yeah. I would be. I would have done great.
Well, okay.
Would you watch Top Gun? I would have been great.
100% realistic.
Right.
I want to know why this works for you, because as you just alluded to, the evidence for backlash against assertive, straightforward women is extensive.
Extensive.
So what's different about the way you do it?
I think about that a lot. A part of it is being a lesbian. They kind of expect it, like, oh, where's your hammer? Oh, great, that kind of thing. And I think sometimes, especially because in this book and where I'm covering is a lot of straight white men, right? They're more comfortable with me than other people. I have aggressive tendencies, entrepreneurial tendencies. Right, like they did. Now, what happens often, I was with this bunch of venture capitalists, and you know, we were at an event, and they were starting to look at a woman. They're starting to talk about her, like, ooh, nice boobs, essentially. And they're like, Kara, what do you think? I go, still a feminist. Yeah, I don't talk about women that way. I clocked that very clearly. They thought I was one of them.
It's such an interesting observation. It reminds me of some work that Ashley Rosette and her colleagues did, where essentially what they show is that if you belong to two clashing, in their work, it's gender and race categories that have different stereotypes, people don't know which stereotypes to apply.
Right.
And so they give you the latitude. You could be feminine or you could be masculine without getting judged as harshly.
I got one uncommonly confident. And I was like, it's not uncommon, actually, but they perceive it as such.
What's uncommon is that you express it. I think this is, in some cases, people mistaking you for one of the tech bros that you cover.
Sometimes.
They think it's a signal of arrogance or narcissism, and it's especially uncommon to hear a woman do it.
Yes, exactly. There's a difference there. I'm very open to other points of view, and I'm open to disagreement, intelligent disagreement.
I have an agenda
Okay,
for
tonight. Let's go.
I'm not attached to it, but I thought we should talk about your personal story a little bit. We've done some of that, but there's more to do. I wanted to get you to riff on some of my favorite insights from Burn Book.
Okay.
One of the things that jumped out at me right away in the book is just how early and how intensely you were enacting this commitment to be honest.
Yes.
So tell us about your call to the Washington Post.
Oh, I loved the Washington Post. I really did. I revered it. And I was a Georgetown student, and I worked for the student newspaper. It was a great newspaper, right? Ben Bradley was running it. It was so legendary. And I covered something they did, which was a visit to campus by a really heinous El Salvadoran, Salvadoran general. And I wrote a piece about it because I was very invested in what was happening there, the murders and everything else. And they wrote a piece, and it was full of errors, and it made me mad because I was like, wow, they did a shoddy job. And so I called them, and I started to complain. And I managed to get the Metro editor, and I started to harangue him, essentially. I was like, this is terrible. This is shoddy. You need to have better standards. Like, how dare you do this? You're my Washington Post. How dare you? And he said, why don't you come down here and say that to my face? I said, I absolutely shall. And so I got on the bus, and I continued my harangue against him in person. And he was so amused by me, you could tell, that he's like, I'm going to hire you. And I was like, good idea, because I'll do a much better job. Thank God I'm here to save you. And I became a stringer from the university. And actually, it was a good idea, because I knew the university, so I would do a better job.
Well, I think it was incredible foreshadowing
yes,
who you were going to become.
Yeah.
Okay, so then the next time when you had to flex that muscle, you had a misogynistic, awful boss.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Tell us what happened there.
So I worked for a guy named John McLaughlin, and he had a show called The McLaughlin Group. It was a bunch of people, left and right reporters, and they would debate the issues of the day, like issue one on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being nuclear Armageddon, that kind of stuff. And he was very dramatic and performative, which was interesting to me. And he was a very big figure in the Reagan administration because he had power. This show had power. I wrote his column, which he wrote in the National Review, which I thought was very funny because I was very liberal. It was an interesting thing to ghostwrite his column and just was good. I was 23, 24 maybe. And he was a sexual harasser of a typical classic sort, like chase people around desks, give me a kiss, honey, that kind of thing. He was also abusive in general, like to staff, he would line people up by height and make them look for dust balls under the couch, which was like, okay. Like it was sort of weird Captain Queeg kind of behavior. And we went to the chief of staff, and we were young women. And this woman, I'll never forget this, said, surely you must be wrong. You must be lying. Now, this was pre-Anita Hill. This is business as usual in Washington. And we were like, no, we're not wrong. And so we quit. We quit. This poor woman had was really badly affected by it. You could see it. She lost her confidence in a lot of ways. And I was just pissed. I was like, how dare he think he can grab this woman? A year later, he did it to someone else. And I was called to testify against him in this lawsuit. And I was deposed, and they did the typical thing, you're a lesbian, you hate men. And I would answer, no, I like men, I don't have to sleep with them. So she settled, which was a disappointment for me. I wanted this to go to court. And then when the Washington Post came to write a piece about it, the writer, his name was Eric Alterman, came to me and he said, I'd like to talk to you about what happened, and you can go off the record. And I said, I don't want to go off the record. Why would I go off the record? If I don't use my name, no one's going to believe it, right? It's going to be sources said, and that's not as powerful. And my feeling was, and I expressed it to him when he was being so abusive, I said, someday you're just going to be wheeling around in a wheelchair eating applesauce, and I'm going to be really powerful. That's where this is going. And he was like, oh, I love that. I was like, okay, sir, but that's how it's going down for you, because I'm young and fast, and you're getting slower by the minute. And so, and he thought that was hysterical. He's a funny guy. Terrible, heinous person. I'm glad he's dead. But I wish, I'm happy some people are dead. I ran into him at a party. I was working for the Washington Post by this time. And he came up to me and he said, he goes, because we're in a town that stabs you in the back, you stab me in the front, which I thought was very funny. And I said, anytime, you son of a bitch. And he went, excellent. And I went, fantastic. I hope I never see you again. And that was the last time I saw him, and he's dead. So there you have it. And then the woman, the chief of staff, who said we must be lying, came up to me at a party and said, do you remember me? I said, oh, yes, I do. And she said, I'm really sorry for what I did then. Will you forgive me? I said, I absolutely will not. We were two young girls, and you knew it was true what we were saying. How dare you? I said, I'm not going to, if you don't mind. And she's like, oh, like she expected me to go, yes, of course. I was like, no, you don't get off on this one. It was a lesson. And so when Clarence Thomas happened, I knew just what was going on there. You knew just what was happening. It happened in the Post newsroom with Juan Williams, too. Similar thing.
I think it's an amazing story of your courage.
Mm-hmm.
Someone with that level of power could give you a horrible reference, could get you blackballed out of jobs, could be, I mean.
That takes a lot of effort, and I wasn't a conservative. I was in the Republican Party, so I didn't see that. Wow. I made a calculation. I still would have done it.
It's what's also unusual, though, is it seems like a strangely cheerful tyrant.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, good job ruining my career.
Right. But I didn't ruin his career. That's the thing. There's no winning until the end, right? And in fact, there's no winning even then. Terrible people can prevail. And I didn't mind that. I just was going to do my part to make sure people understood what he was doing. I really do believe in Christiane Amanpour, who I'm a huge fan of, and she's a friend of mine, which is her truthful, not neutral kind of stance, which she just articulated so beautifully. But that's sort of been my motto, that kind of thing. So.
I think about that every time somebody says, we need to hear both sides of the story. I'm like, well, yeah, we need to hear
both truthful sides.
Exactly. And weigh the side with more evidence more heavily.
Yes, exactly. I think it's a really great way to go through the world as a person, and I think it's a good way to be a journalist, I think.
I want to talk about some of the aha moments that I had while I was reading this book. Okay. You had a really early and prescient take on the lack of fancy offices.
Yes,
and
I did.
Dress codes.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people took that as a signal that this was a new and humble group of people.
Yeah.
Who didn't care about status.
Right.
And you didn't think so.
No, I thought it was so performative. And I did one story I did, and I had forgotten I did it. So I guess I really did think this at the time, which was they had all these sayings when you'd go visit them, like, we're all the same people. We're all equal here. And I was like, well, why do you have stock that gives you full control of everything and nobody else control? I had covered retail before. I had covered a bunch of companies. And I never heard out of the mouth of, say, a Wall Street person, we're here to build community. They're here to make money. Like, I got it. Like, I'm good with it. But they were very much in need of having you think they were good people to a point that was ridiculous, which is why the first line of the book was, so it was capitalism after all, because it was such bullshit that it wasn't from the very beginning. They weren't here to help us. They were here to help themselves, which, again, that's fine as long as we establish the rules at the beginning.
Can't it be both?
Can, but they spent a lot of time doing damage and pretending they didn't do it and continue to this day. When someone tells you something over and over again, I think it's a little suspect. I'm a really nice person. I'm not a bitch. I'm like, bitch. Like, you know what I mean?
Who are you trying to convince, me or yourself?
Right.
It's almost as if in Silicon Valley, looking like you don't care about status symbols is itself a sign of status.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
How did that come to be?
I guess it's more comfortable clothes. They like soft pants, but okay, you know. But they're expensive. They get so insulated by wealth. Wealth really is a mind fuck. It really is. Not for everybody, by the way, but for a lot of people who don't have stronger characters, it creates a lot of enablers and creates a lot of comfort. And then you don't talk to regular people. And then you think you're a populist. That's my favorite part is that let's get the man. I'm like, you are the man.
Another point I found really thought-provoking in the book was your twist on the Edison quote. I cannot tell you how many times I've heard this quoted. Not just tech companies, any company that's trying to innovate. I didn't fail. I just found 10,000 ways that didn't work.
Yeah, they love that quote.
You're not such a fan.
I'm not a fan of that quote. There are ways to fail, and they failed many times. Again, it's a suspension of actual truth in order to get somewhere. And adults in tech did say that. Like when Apple did a social network called Ping, which you don't remember because it was terrible. And when Steve came out and said, what do you think? I'm like, I mean, it sucks. Just right from the get-go, it sucks. And he went, well, it does, doesn't it? And I was like, it does. Like, he could recognize that. And that's because he was an adult. There's a lot of people you can have discussions with where they don't take it as a personal affront when you don't agree with them. Other people, not so much. It has to be, it wasn't a failure. It was a victory, really, hidden in a failure. And I'm like, how about it was just a failure?
I've long thought that self-justification is maybe the cousin of self-deception.
Right.
They work together.
You need some of that, right?
Oh, don't
you think? You need a little bit of suspension of disbelief.
A little bit, yeah. Mm-hmm. But let's then do the post-mortem.
Right.
Ideally, actually, we do the pre-mortem.
Right.
And say, what are all the ways this could fail?
Correct.
Let's try to prevent those.
Yeah, yeah. But a lot of people don't do that. And they can't entertain failure as anything that's useful. Right? For some reason. They call it Pivot, which is the name of my podcast. It's a joke name.
Ironically.
No, we named it because of that. We're making fun of them secretly.
The other thing you point out that I think is problematic, and I'm going to quote you on this. Mm-hmm. You said, when you say you didn't fail, you just found ways that didn't work. That leaves out a lot about who's responsible, and real people get hurt.
Right. And they don't take responsibility, and they continue not to take responsibility because it couldn't be them. Because they've given us this gift to the world, which, by the way, they borrowed from the American taxpayers. But they never think that they did things on the shoulders of other people. And that's weird. I find that weird and immature. And they have grievances when they're the luckiest people in the world, where it's like, you know, I am a victim. I am getting, you know, hit jobs, this and that, when you're just asking them a normal question.
Well, this goes to our first would-be fight, your ratio.
I do let people off with a prick-to-productivity ratio. I was doing an event with Ted Sarandos in Los Angeles, and he was like, Steve could be a jerk. He yelled at us once. And I said, did he call you a moron? Did he make a remark about you personally? He goes, no. He was mad about the color of the Netscape, of the Netflix button. He didn't like the red. He thought the red was terrible, and he yelled at us about the red. I'm like, fair game. I don't care if he didn't like the red. I don't mind that kind of stuff when it's work, when it's product. People get very passionate about product. When you move into really that you have to demean groups of people in order to elevate yourself, that's different to me. I think I can get very passionate about my products, like what I want to make and what I want to do. And I try to be a little nicer than that, but I definitely get what I want, right? I get what when I want to do it.
I see your case for tolerating it more if it's mission related.
There's a line that everybody knows gets crossed when it gets into personal, like you stupid moron, you, that kind of stuff. I don't think is at all cool.
Yeah, so you're okay with someone saying, this sucks. You just don't want to hear, you suck.
You suck, that's correct.
I was surprised to read that you don't like the phrase, speak truth to power.
I don't.
I completely disagree. Tell me why.
Because I think it's just a trope now. I liked it before it got used too much. I think it's overused. It's a sort of a catch-all phrase when you're not really speaking truth to power, so I don't think it's useful anymore. I think there's lots of other ways to express it.
That I find more compelling than something else you wrote about, which is you said you think it assumes that power is bad.
I don't think all power is bad. I think it can become bad. I know that that's the second one you get to the trope, which is all power corrupts.
Power corrupts.
Maybe some of it does. Some of it I've seen used really well.
Wholeheartedly, to add a little nuance.
Right.
I don't think speak truth to power assumes power is bad. I think it assumes that power is deaf and blind.
I don't think that. I've had lots of really interesting discussions with very powerful people that are listening, that do listen.
Without question, but yes. I think you would be the first to grant that the more powerful you become, the harder it is to get people to be honest with you.
Yeah, that is true, but I think some people do seek it out. Not everybody, but and it always surprises me. And there is a point where you don't want to hear it anymore because you get too much incoming. I mean, one of the funniest fights I had was with Barack Obama. I didn't agree with him on encryption, right? And he's so used to being agreed with because everyone loves him, right? And I thought he was completely wrong about encryption and the way he shifted. And we were in an interview, and before we sat down, we were knee to knee in my red chairs, and I said, listen, they cut 10 minutes from my thing here, but here's the deal. You tend to talk in paragraphs, and you never stop talking because, you know, I'm sure you're in a room with people, and they're like, the president gets to talk, and nobody talks back at you, but I'm going to have to interrupt you now a lot more than you're used to because I know you're not used to it because I can see by the way you talk, but you need to be interrupted, and it's going to be hard for you because you haven't done it in years, like you don't carry money anymore, but I'm going to interrupt you. And so get ready for it. And he looked at me, he goes, I heard you're obnoxious. I said, yes, I am. And then we started the interview.
You want the person who thinks in paragraphs but talks in sound bites sometimes.
No, I don't want sound bites. He literally never stops talking. I'm sorry, he still doesn't do it. Like, we had lunch recently, and I was like, oh, my God, stop talking. You're not the president anymore.
And this is one of the things that I think interesting about what people often don't see you do behind the scenes.
Which is
you're explaining, hey, like, I'm not trying to attack you or make you feel bad. I'm trying to make this more interesting.
Right.
I'm trying to surface areas
of
tension.
One of the things I do is I tend to ask the harder questions at the top because they're waiting for them. Like when I did Jon Stewart, I was like, I think you may have become irrelevant and let's talk about that. And he said, oh my God. And I said, what? And he goes, you know, a lot of people do think that. And then he gave an amazing answer about it.
So I have to tell you, I don't think there are a lot of burns in this book.
Really? Interesting.
I was picturing Mean Girls.
Oh.
Shock value comments.
Yeah, but that's
a joke. And I think you're fair to people.
That's correct. That's the whole point. I am fair. I think one of the things that always happens when I interview people is they start with the you're mean, and I'm like, where am I mean? I think I'm fair and tough on people. I think this is my take, and one of the interesting things when I get reviews is everyone always writes the book they wanted me to write, and I'm like, fuck you, I wrote the book I wanted to write.
There are a few people that you're tougher on than I would have been, and a few people you're nicer to than I would have been.
Yeah.
One that surprised me in how harsh you were was Jeff Bezos.
Harsh?
Yes. Well, okay. I want to have you elaborate on this, but you said that your first thought about him when you met him was feral.
Mm-hmm.
You also said, I had no doubt that Jeff Bezos would eat my face off if that's what he needed to do to get ahead.
Yeah.
That's a strong statement.
I don't think so.
Your face off.
Well, feral. He was
a little doubt for that.
He's a tough son of a bitch. I think he would like that characterization of him. He's not a nice guy, in business at least. Feral is not necessarily bad. And you know what? It was such a joy to go up to Seattle and see that. I was like, thank you, because all these tech people in their comfortable fleece, they were sharks dressed in fleece. He was just a shark. And I was like, thank you. I know who you are. And I appreciated that. And I liked him for that. Like, he did not hide. He didn't pretend, and he didn't create a culture there that pretended.
Support for the show comes from Brooks Running. I'm so excited because I have been a runner, gosh, my entire adult life. And for as long as I can remember, I have run with Brooks running shoes. Now I'm running with a pair of Ghost 16s from Brooks. Incredibly lightweight shoes that have really soft cushioning. It feels just right when I'm hitting my running trail that's just out behind my house. You now can take your daily run in the better than ever Ghost 16. You can visit brooksrunning.com to learn more.
All right, let's go to the lightning round.
Okay.
Worst career advice you've ever gotten?
Get in line. I don't get in line. I think sometimes you need to be trained. I think a lot of people think they can jump ahead without training. I do believe in training and mentorship. So,
who is your dream Pivot co-host during Scott Free August?
Oh, I like them all.
That you haven't had?
Oh.
That you want?
Taylor Swift. Obviously. She's a kid. Speaking of killer business people, man, she would leave you naked without clothes if she needed to. And I like it, and I'm down for it. I'm good with it.
Okay, so Taylor Swift for co-host. My nominee was going to be Sam Altman.
Oh, Sam was good. He was good.
Unbelievably good.
One of the things he did at that interview that I just did in San Francisco was, I thought we'd be talking about AI, and he goes, you know, you write a lot about your father in this book, and you don't mention your mother at all except one slightly negative thing. And what's with that? That's how he said it. And I was like, oh, man, he's good. And he goes, I really think there's something there. And I said, and my brother was in the audience, and he yells, run, Kara. And I said, that's my next book. And it is indeed.
From what I've heard, he got closer than anyone else
Absolutely.
To being like you
yes,
as the
exactly.
interviewer. Who is your dream guest that you've never gotten?
Taylor Swift with Dolly Parton and only talk about business, because I think they're both killer entrepreneurs and really smart. I don't want to talk about boyfriends, and I don't want to talk about Tennessee and mandolins. I don't care.
What's a personal belief you held that changed based on your career experience?
I used to think things were a lot more simple, and I think I've gotten better at understanding complexity.
What's something you're rethinking right now?
Television, cable television. I think everyone's against it.
The existence of it?
No, I think it's just everyone's like, it's over. I'm like, it's not over. It's not. There's just a worldwide global network, television network, for example. That's why I signed a deal with CNN. Everyone was like, what's she doing? I'm like, well, you'll see, won't you? Like, podcasting was the same thing. Everyone was like, what's she doing? I'm like, you'll see. So, whatever. None of your business.
Who is the most underrated person in Silicon Valley?
Oh, that's a good question.
I wrote it myself.
Dr. Fei-Fei Li. She was at the beginning of AI. This new AI stuff doesn't get the credit she deserves. She's written a great book and just a wonderful, a nuanced person, which is so rare.
Also way ahead of the curve on AI safety.
Way. And she's right. A human-centered AI. I just think she's such an important. I've urged them to put her on the board of OpenAI.
Most interesting tech person that we haven't heard of?
You know, the guy I wrote about many years ago, the real founder of AOL. This guy named Bill von Meissen, not Steve Case. He didn't found it. He was a vice president there. He took it to places. That's different. But the founder was this really wonderful creator. He really understood online spaces, named Bill von Meister, and totally failed and didn't benefit it from any way. I love those stories, who were there first and didn't benefit. He was just a brilliant thinker on this stuff, and none of which helped him.
Built almost all of social media before we had social media.
Absolutely. He was thinking around corners.
What's the question you have for me?
What's the most hyped thing in business that you really would like to get rid of?
This is like choosing my least favorite child. If I had to pick one right now, it would be in-office work.
Meaning?
It's an easy one. Meaning everybody has to come in the entire week.
I disagree with you, but...
Really?
Yeah. I think there's a lot to
be evidence said. Disagrees with you.
I understand that, but I think people not... It's like school. If you have kids, it didn't work. They needed to be
together. I'm just saying a day or two a week from anywhere. It's
okay.
The best of both worlds.
Okay. Right.
The people who can't stomach that, I think, are going to be obsolete really quickly.
I've been remote my whole career, which is interesting. But I found there are some really great things about gathering.
Absolutely, without question. Before we wrap tonight, let's talk a little bit about the future. Mm-hmm. How do you balance holding tech accountable with having good relationships with people?
I think what the press did is they were too easy on tech, and then
they overcorrected.
And I think it's somewhere in the middle. And people don't like that somewhere in the middle for some reason. There have to be, like, calling Mark Zuckerberg a villain, he's not a villain, but he's dangerous at the same time.
A couple of people asked about this, which is something I've noticed a lot in Silicon Valley, particularly tech companies run by engineers,
tend
to not respect non-engineers.
Yes, that's ridiculous.
What advice do you have for navigating that?
I'll tell you my own personal advice. My son is a computer. He's taking physics. He's taking advanced calculus. He's taking computer science. But what I insisted in high school and now is that he takes history courses, ethics courses. He likes them too, by the way. I don't think you can be a really good technologist unless you understand history. The better technologists have a wider range of references. Steve Jobs is a very good example. Tim Cook is wide-ranging. And so if you don't have a broader education, you have no business making decisions about society. And you've seen it played out over and over again.
What about if you can't force them to take these courses and broaden their horizons? What if you're stuck working in one of those environments?
Read a book.
I cannot disagree with that advice. Mm-hmm. I guess the other journalism thread that came up is, how do we save journalism and how do we save journalists' livelihoods?
It's been happening for a long time. The business models don't mesh up. The cost and revenue don't messed up, and they've been keeping the same cost structure in a revenue. They just sat there, and they continue to sit there, and they still do today, creating these structures that are non-economic. And now they're relying on the kindness of billionaires, whether it's Jeff Bezos or Lorraine Powell Jobs or Mark Benioff. That's not a business plan. It just isn't. So you see all these really interesting small companies that are very similar to what we did at All Things D and then Recode. They're just doing it better. We were kind of early to the game in that. But you have stuff like a Casey Newton at Platformer, who's just two or three employees, but he's making a lot of money, like a lot of money, and has a lot of influence too, by the way, on a very small budget. Puck is another example. The Information, there's dozens of examples like that that are, like, Heather Cox Richardson is making bank, people. Like, you don't know, and she's
dominating
substance. It's her up in Maine at a desk. That's pretty much it. Is that journalism? Is something? Is something good? And so I think these companies have to rethink it beyond a billionaire will save us, or we should get public funding because that's not happening in this country. We're not Britain, and it's too partisan. And so they have to right-size their businesses. And journalists get mad at me about this as if they're priests. I'm like, it's called the news business, right? Like, it's show business, and they just haven't changed fast enough. And in the new world that's coming, you think before was hard? Next is even harder.
Okay, that's the last topic, AI. What's your biggest fear? What's your biggest fix?
AI?
Yeah.
People that are bad people, they're coming. And they're here. Everyone's like, are you scared of AI? Is it going to kill us? I'm scared of bad people using these tools as weapons, always. Every single technology has been turned into a weapon, and this one's a big one. And so bad people doing things, and I could think of 50 things they could do just sitting down, and an AI could think of 400 things they could do. And so I worry about people using these new technologies badly. And so I worry about lack of regulation. We don't have any. We worry about lack of liability. These are things that don't slow innovation. They improve innovation. They do. It's such a lie that technologists tell you is that they need an unfettered landscape. Honestly, it's like only a child would say that. And so they need guardrails, and that's what I worry about. And sometimes it'll be the stuff that you're not going to think of. And if someone said, think of something, and I said, okay, we tell AI to solve world hunger for us, because hunger is bad, and without the guardrails or the right instructions, it will kill a billion people, too. That's the way you solve hunger, less people. And then let's eat them. Like, you can see it. Like, that's the plot of Soylent Green, by the way. That's what it's going to do if we don't think about it as human beings and protect humanity in that way. So that worries me.
And your guardrail solutions are?
Are regulation. There hasn't been any on technology ever. That's because technology moved into the space right when our political system was fracturing. And so imagine Standard Oil didn't have trust busters, or AT&T didn't have politicians willing to break it up. We wouldn't have cell phones. We wouldn't have all these advanced technologies because that got broken up and created all kinds of innovation. Lack of regulations by our elected officials. And I'll end on this. When Mark Zuckerberg appeared before the Relations Committee, and Josh Hawley said, turn around and apologize. Parents had pictures of their kids that were hurt by social media, doubtlessly due to Facebook and the way they built their system. Put up the pictures, and I said, turn the pictures around and look at Josh Hawley. Who in this room could do something about it? Oh, you performative son of a bitch. Like, you're the one who can write the rules and cooperate with people. Instead, you're interested in what you could tweet next. You're loathsome on that regard. All these regulators could do something about it, and they don't. You know, they don't. They do nothing. And so I blame Mark Zuckerberg, too, but honestly, he's doing what he's doing. He's a capitalist. He's making shareholders happy. But he did turn around and look at them. And in his eyes, you could see, what have I done? But why am I waiting for that guy? Why are we waiting for him to get educated? We have to just say, that's enough. And let's pass some laws. Like, let's have
Europe's
a few.
Europe's way ahead of
Europe's
us.
Way ahead. Let's have a few more Margrethe vestiges here in this country and with the courage to do something about it. So
that sounds like an action plan.
It is. I have 4 kids. I care about what happens. And I want them to do their job. I do. But, you know, they're busy doing other things, like, you know, whatever they're doing up there. But we elected them, so.
Well, Kara, I will
say, by the way, we can unelect them. That's the thing. You can't unelect Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk, so.
That's true. Well, I hate to wrap it here because there's a lot more we can talk about, but let me just end by saying that I want every leader with an important job to have you as a thorn in their side.
But I'm not burning them enough. No, I'm kidding.
No, I mean, I think you as an irritant is a force for
irritant good. Irritant is good. So no, wait, that's how we get pearls, Adam. That's how we get pearls.
Rethinking is hosted by me, Adam Grant. This show is part of the TED Audio Collective, and this episode was produced and mixed by Cosmic Standard. Our producers are Hannah Kingsley Ma and Asia Simpson. Our editor is Alejandra Salazar. Our fact checker is Paul Durbin. Original music by Hansdale Stew and Allison Leighton Brown. Our team includes Eliza Smith, Jacob Winnick, Samaya Adams, Michelle Quint, Banban Cheng, Julia Dickerson, and Whitney Pennington Rogers.
My ex-wife was the CTO of America. When you leave the White House, the families go in and meet the president. You get the picture, you shake the hand. And so I walk in, and he looks at me. He goes, how did you get in here? And then my second favorite part is I have a very jolly son, my older son, and he's like, Louie, I hear you're a good cook, and when you own a restaurant, can I come? And Louie's like, absolutely, sir. You know, that's great. And then he turned to my other son, who's much more disagreeable, and I really enjoy that about him. He goes, Alex, I hear you're going to do a startup someday. When you have a company, can I invest in it? My son goes, maybe. We'll see. And he turns to me and he goes, that's your kid. I'm like, yes, he is. Yes, he is. I'm very proud of you for that, Al. I was like, yay, parenting done.